Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The great singer-songwriter John Prine has been described as the Cliff Clavin of folk music.
What's up with that?
You may be wondering, by who? By me. Aren't you listening? Why do I call him that? Because for a while, John worked as a mailman, and Cliff Clavin is the most famous mailman I can think of. John often came up with ideas for his songs while he was working for the Postal Service. So says Erin Osman. She's a music journalist and the author of the book, John Prine. John's self-titled debut album was released 50 years ago and is still influential. Erin talked with Beta's Steve Gotcher about John's journey from Western Kentucky to the folk scene in Chicago and beyond, to his status as one of the greatest American singer-songwriters ever.
John tended to write directly from his life, directly from his day-to-day experiences. That's sort of a mark of his work that I think is really important, because he tended to illuminate these people and characters and places that had never been celebrated in song before. Like when we think about songs like 6 o'clock News on the self-titled album, that story comes directly from a kid he grew up with in Maywood.
All around the schoolyard, playing all the games, running, laughing, back and forth, the kid with two first names. Stranger in the closet, lock the diary, the past is running faster, singing harmony. Come on, baby, spend the night with me.
When we think of Paradise, that's drawn directly from his experiences visiting family in Muhlenberg County. When we think of Far From Me, a lot of that kind of heartbreak and sadness in that song is drawn directly from Prine's first girlfriend, like childhood girlfriend, who worked at a local cafe, who really broke his heart. That's really what he was doing. He wasn't trying to make great works of fiction, but he sort of just borrowed from his day-to-day life and translated that into really striking lyrics that have this poetic clarity that I think really resonates with the listener.
But there is a song like Donald and Lydia that isn't really a true story, is it?
No, I mean, that song was drawn from Prine's time in boot camp in Louisiana. And he lived in the barracks, obviously, in boot camp, and in these kind of army towns that are set up all over the world, there tends to be, you know, like a few services adjacent to the barracks, but it's pretty bare bones, these little towns. And so he imagined a soldier, Donald, who was like him and his friends, kind of laying in the barracks, shaved heads, bunk beds, right? And then he imagined a woman who worked in the adjacent town, and kind of how they're both very different people and they never really meet, but they have the same shared sense of longing for love and acceptance, right, in society. And again, that's like another example of Prine sort of illuminating these characters who aren't talked about a lot or aren't celebrated or represented.
But dreaming just comes natural, like the first breath from a baby, like sunshine feeding daisy, like the love hidden deep in your heart.
So what do you think is the secret to John Prine's songwriting? His songs were so unique and so relatable. How did he do that? You know?
I think he did it because he kept it simple. When we think about like great Midwestern songwriters, of course, like Bob Dylan comes to mind, but you know, a lot of people compared Prine and Bob Dylan whenever this self-titled album came out. But with Prine, there was just such a sense of simplicity and modesty, kind of this desire to kind of get down one-to-one with folks. Prine never wanted to alienate the listener. He wanted to invite as many people in as possible, I think. And so that's why he wrote such simple yet profound statements through his lyrics. And I also think that, you know, maybe he just was writing the way that he would speak. You know, he wasn't like a fancy guy. He came from a modest background. And I think that informed who he was as a person, and he never got away from that.
Now, we talked a bit about Paradise before, but tell me a little bit more about that song because it's so powerful.
Yeah, it really is. And I think, you know, maybe like new listeners especially, but I think a lot of folks consider this song like a parable or something. But actually, it's true. It's taken from true events that took down the town of Paradise, Kentucky. It's where Prine's family was from on both sides, actually. His mom and his dad's sides were both from Muhlenberg County in Kentucky. He spent summers and varying holidays going down there to kind of hang out with his extended kin. And over the years, he witnessed the destruction of that like very beautiful ancestral land by corporate coal mining. All of the lyrics from that song are basically taken directly from the papers and directly from Prine's observations of the destruction of this town.
And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
Prine felt moved and felt sad enough and felt a poignancy to kind of capture that. And also, you know, it was a song for his father. His father loved that part of the world, a part of our country. And so he wrote it for his dad, and he wrote it to sort of convey his sadness and his frustration with corporate destruction.
Now let's back up and talk a little bit about John's history. The Old Town School of Folk Music played a role in developing John as a musician. How big of an impact did that have on helping him find his way?
The Old Town School of Folk Music is a very important and prestigious folk music school in Chicago. I think of it as like the preeminent folk music school in our country. And John was introduced to it through his older brother, Dave Prine, who's the oldest of the four Prine brothers, was really swept up in the folk music revival in Chicago. He loved like the new Lost City Ramblers and folks like that. And so he started taking lessons at OTS. And eventually he said, John, you know, I've taught you a couple chords. You seem very interested in this. Like, why don't you come to the school? Like, why don't you come and learn? His teacher, Ray Tate, who was the lead guitar teacher at OTS at the time, described Prine as a very focused, dedicated student who really wanted to learn finger picking and fingerstyle guitar. And Prine's local discovery in the club scene actually came as a product of OTS. Ray Tate and some other teachers at OTS founded a club called the Fifth Peg. It was across the street from the OTS location in Lincoln Park. And Ray Tate is the first person that ever put Prine up on the stage. And that's sort of how people, locals, discovered that John Prine, this unassuming mailman in the suburbs, was writing these amazing songs.
Now, a young movie critic for the Chicago Sun-Times by the name of Roger Ebert had a role in spreading the word about John Prine. How did that happen?
Yeah. In the 60s and 70s, Old Town was the hub of Chicago bohemia. It was the hub of the folk music scene. It was the hub of sort of underground comedy and theater troupes. And it's where all the hippies and, you know, all the cool people hung out. And Roger Ebert was very much a part of that scene. He was the local arts critic, and he definitely hung out at the bars in Old Town, you know, ordering beer and shot specials and, you know, hanging out with folks like Shel Silverstein and Studs Terkel and, you know, all the folks, the literati on the scene. So yeah, Roger had gone to see a film to potentially review, and he thought it was so rotten that he walked out. And instead, he walked down to the Fifth Peg and happened upon Prine. You know, he didn't write about music. That wasn't his beat. But after he saw Prine's set, he felt moved enough to sort of share the news of a new local talent. And so instead of his Friday movie review, he reviewed Prine's set at the Fifth Peg. And from there, all of Chicago took notice, because by then, Roger was a respected critic, right? And he was a Chicago personality, and that made Chicagoans take notice. And so, of course, after Roger's review, folks started trickling in. You know, they wanted to be at the feet of the singing mailman. You know, there was a lot of intrigue there.
Yeah. And speaking of people who Chicago loves, Steve Goodman was a good friend of John Prine's. And Goodman did some things to help advance John's career. What kind of things did he do?
Oh, man. Yeah. Steve and John were thick as thieves. They were so close. And the thing to know about them is they were sort of like mirror twins in a way. Like, Steve was a born performer. He had like a great personality. He was super outgoing, and he was just a showman. Whereas Prine, John Prine, was more introverted, a little more shy, a little more of a reluctant performer. And so I think they really complemented each other in that way. But Steve really encouraged Prine. He really pushed him to sort of look beyond the Chicago club scene. So he did a couple of things. One, he convinced Kris Kristofferson to go check out Prine's set one night after hours. Then he convinced Prine to go to New York to record some demos. They had an offer from the Canadian pop star Paul Anka, offered to fly the pair out to go record some demos in New York, and was like, hey, kids, I'm going to help get you a record deal. And Prine was kind of like, why would I do that? I'm happy here. And Steve Goodman was kind of like, are you nuts? Like, of course we're going to New York. So he really was like the enthusiast, and he really pushed Prine out of his comfort zone in those early days. And without Steve Goodman's sort of enthusiasm and goodwill toward his friend, I'm not sure, you know, if any of this would have happened as quickly for Prine as it did.
Right. And the amazing thing is, not only was Steve so selfless, but Kris Kristofferson really put himself out for John Prine. What kind of things did he do?
Yeah. So the big sort of transformative moment with Kristofferson was when they got to New York to record those demos. Steve and John got off the plane and they picked up a copy of the Village Voice at the airport. And they saw that Kris Kristofferson was playing at the Bitter End that night. And they were like, wow, this is, you know, what a coincidence. So of course they headed to Greenwich Village to go check out the set. And when they got there, Kristofferson saw them in the street, came over and said, you guys got to open for me. So he insisted that Steve and John each do a couple of songs to open. But what he didn't tell them, and I don't know if it's because he didn't know or because he just didn't want to freak them out, was that it was sort of a label showcase that night. There were label representatives in the audience. And so what ended up happening is Jerry Wexler from Atlantic Records was in the audience at the Bitter End, and he decided to sign Prime. It was their first folk artist signing, and it happened because of Kris Kristofferson's generosity.
Well, once he got to New York City and he was signed to Atlantic Records, they sent him to Memphis to record his first album, John Prine, at American Sound Studios. And the backup band for the recording was a group called the Memphis Boys, who were the Memphis equivalent of L.A.'s famous session band, The Wrecking Crew. And they didn't have any experience with folk music, but they found arrangements that worked well with Prine's writing. How were they able to do that?
Yeah, it's all pretty amazing because, you know, as you said, they didn't have a lot of experience playing with folk musicians. They'd played on some country records, so that helped. Like, they were certainly capable of the country portion of Prine's repertoire. But then the producer, Arif Mardran, had never produced a folk record. So everyone was green, in a sense, in this session. But the great thing about the Memphis Boys is that they are total professionals. They know that they are hired by record labels to make hits, right? And if they don't deliver on that, then they failed. They work really hard to sort of service the songs that are given to them. You know, the way that they describe it is they play by feel. They kind of fall in together and just try to foster the song as much as they could. And they knew, and they knew correctly, that Prine's stuff was really about the lyrics. Right. So eventually they all kind of dove into the lyrics and paid close attention to the lyrics and tried to highlight the words as much as they could.
Is there a particular song you think that highlights how well the band fit into John's music?
Yeah, I mean, I really like what they did on Far From Me. Far From Me is my favorite song on this album. And I think it's just because it translates as such a classic country song. And I think that's what those lyrics necessitate. But it's got this timelessness, and it has this poignancy and this sadness that I think just is really universal. And I think from the production side, they really did a good job highlighting that.
And the sky is black and still now on the hill. Looks just like a diamond ring, but it's far, far from me.
Now, you mentioned a song that you thought was your favorite song, and I have to say that for me, Angel from Montgomery is one of the greatest songs, the best songs ever written. I don't know if you agree with that or if you feel as strongly as I do, but what do you think makes that song so powerful and so unique?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. Angel for Montgomery is such an incredible song, and it definitely is in the Great American Songbook at this point. You know, it's a standard. And I think something that really makes it stand out is, A, It's an example of Prine's deep empathy for sort of populations or people that aren't him, but who he sort of observes and feels for. And particularly in this song, you know, he was like 20 years old writing about a middle-aged woman who feels older than she is.
I am an old woman named after my mother. My old man is another child that's grown old. If dreams were lightning, thunder were desire, this old house would have burnt down a long time ago.
I don't think people think of feminism when they think of John Prine, but I think this song in particular just is an example of his tacit sort of implied feminism because, you know, she's singing in the first person.
How do you think John Prine's going to be remembered in future generations?
As one of the greatest songwriters that's ever lived. And I think that the reason for that is that any new songwriter that you're a fan of, that any of us are fans of, will always cite John Prine. Will always be influenced by John Prine, will always be in awe of John Prine, because nobody can do what he did. People try, but no one will ever touch the guy. And I think that's why he will be constantly in the conversation. He's a perpetual source of inspiration for musicians and writers.
Well, Aaron Ossman, it's a great pleasure to talk to you again. Your book is brilliant. I look forward to the next one. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Aaron Ossman is a music journalist and the author of the book, John Prine. She talked with Steve Gotcher. You can find out more at wpr.org/beta.
Raising beams of incredible dreams, now quiet man.
Now, all the films are connected by this concept of monster, but he always says that in everything he's made, the true monster is the human being.
Film critic Ian Nathan joins us to talk about the visionary director Guillermo del Toro. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.